Radio CSS Media,
your source for family-centered content.
RadioCSS.com.
And now, Audio Theater Central.
Oh, hi there. I'm John Avery Whittaker. But most folks around here call me Whit.
My name is Finian Jones, and you are...
Hello, I'm Dave Arnold, your host for Focus on the Family Radio Theater.
Hey everybody, I'm JD.
And I'm Roy.
And I'm Andrew. We're your hosts for Audio Theater Central.
Welcome everybody to episode 35.
It is so great to have you with us, ready to explore some more family-friendly audio drama, because I think that's what we do around here.
Yes, our title.
Audio Usually.
Audio Theater Central, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Central, for your central place for audio theater.
Exactly.
We are centered around audio theater drama-ness.
Yes.
Precisely, or maybe not so precisely, but something like that. Well, today we've got a very special episode. No review today, but we've got a chat with Chuck Bolte. We've got a newscast. We're just going to have a great time in this episode. I guess I'm the only one going to have a great time.
No, Roy is obviously going to have a great time, but he's nodding over here. This is radio, Roy. You have to like say yes.
Yes. Nod, yes. Nod, nod. Yes.
Can't just
head
nod
movement
your head.
Up and down. Yes. Yes. Yeah, we're going to have a great time today.
Definitely. Yes. And what are we going to kick things off with?
For tonight. Our newscast, of course.
Yes, way to introduce yourself, Roy.
You're free to do motions along with the newscast, but just make sure you speak as well.
Miming the newscast. You should try that one time, Roy.
You should try it right now.
Might be boring for our listeners, but we'd be interested.
Adventures in Odyssey Album 57, A Call to Something More, will begin airing on the radio on August 10, 2013. The digital download will be released around the same time, and the CD version will follow in October. The official Adventures in Odyssey podcast recently featured a two-part interview with Dave Jave Griffin, in which he shared about his work as Jimmy Barkley. You won't want to miss these episodes. That's it for the news this time. I'm Roy, reporting for Audio Theater Central. Did you see my Jimmy Barkley impersonation? Like, that was my mime of Jimmy Barkley.
Very good.
Did you catch that?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
For those of you who missed it, which would be everyone, you missed it. It was very good.
Well, today we are really excited to share with you an interview with Chuck Bolte, who obviously was the former executive producer for Adventures in Odyssey, and we know everybody knows him as the voice of George Barkley. And Andrew and I were privileged to be able to meet up with him a few days ago in a coffee shop and just chat with him about his work on Adventures in Odyssey in both the executive producer capacity and as one of the main actors for many, many years. So you're going to hear a little bit of background noise, or a lot of background noise. But, you know, it was a coffee shop, so really can't do a whole lot about that. But hopefully it won't detract from the content, because of course, Chuck is an amazing actor, and it was great to just chat with him about all of his work on the series for so many years, and let's listen to that now.
Chuck, it is such a pleasure to be able to meet you.
Thanks a lot. Nice to meet you guys, too. Glad to be here.
Well, first off, we wanted to just dive into a little bit about the production side of things, and then we'll delve into the acting, but first of all, how did you get involved with Adventures in Odyssey to begin with?
Well, how do I answer that briefly? It's not a terribly brief answer. How I got involved initially was actually through a gentleman named Mike Trout. I had been in Christian music for 17 years, and I had a group called Jeremiah People. And we had done music and comedy and dramas with an organization called Continental Singers. And we recorded with record company named Light Records. They're part of Word Records. And Mike, at the time when we were recording, was doing engineer work for Light Records, and Ralph Carmichael, who was the president of the company, We had a week in, had a weekly radio show that they actually did on old LPs. This is way back when. And they'd send out to radio stations. And because I was one of the artists, he had interviewed me. And so that's how I got to know Mike. And I started to hire Mike to do some things. And then when Mike, and incidentally, I should mention, I know Mike will appreciate this. I hired him to edit a lot of editing work because he was an incredible editor back in the pre-digital days. Can tape edit. He was an amazing tape editor. But I never hired him to do any voice work, which is what he eventually ended up doing full-time at Focus when he shifted over to Focus and was the co-host on the broadcast. And when Mike shifted over to Focus, he called me to produce a couple of spots that they needed some talent on and some writing, which I did. And out of that, Steve Harris, who was on staff at Focus, was charged with doing testing some radio a radio drama or two that Dr. Dobson wanted to do. So Steve wrote the first radio drama, and I cast it and performed on it. And I'm absolutely blank on the name of it. There was two of them. One was House Guest, I think, was called, and the other was something about Thanksgiving. But both of them, I involved Hal Smith on. I had worked with Hal back in, I don't even know what years it was, but a number of years ago, doing a Christmas show with Continental Singers, a recorded show, album. And so got to know Hal then and then brought him in to do the show, and we all hit it off great. He hit it off great. Out of that, then that led to the initial 13-part series of Family Portraits. So that's how I got into this. The long answer to short question, short answer is through Mike Trout. It was my initial contact.
Okay. When you were executive producer of Adventures in Odyssey, could you kind of walk us through what your normal day would be like? What are the kind of the duties and responsibilities involved with all that?
Sure. Well, initially, what was interesting about this was that when I came on board as executive producer, I was executive producer for the whole broadcast division. And Odyssey was my primary job because Steve Harris and Phil had been charged to launch this thing. I had been involved as a consultant and a contract person for that year that the Portraits, Family Portraits was launched. That was January through, I think, May or something like that. And then this was, Odyssey was to be launched in the fall of 1987. And so when I came on board, I came on and things, and Steve and Phil would admit this, were a bit chaotic. They were already behind schedule, really behind the eight ball. And it was because Odyssey was actually an add-on for them. They already had full-time jobs. They're working in their creative division. And so they were told to do this Odyssey thing too. So they worked their tails off and did a great job, but were just overwhelmed by the amount of work. When I came on board, Paul McCusker was a friend, and he and I had worked together before. And we came on together, and he helped add to the writing staff. And I basically, during the early time, kind of just basically took control of things and gave assignments and helped shape where it was going. And then to answer your question more briefly, what my day would look like when it came to Odyssey would be, my role was to initiate the creative sessions, oversee and guide the creative sessions. It wasn't just me, it wasn't just Phil, it wasn't just Steve, it wasn't just Paul. It was really a great team working together. And the engineers, Bob Luttrell and Dave Arnold. And through engineering that, working and kind of guiding that, that's where Odyssey kind of was birthed and launched and actually grew too. So my role was also in helping, if somebody had a character idea or we had a problem to solve, I would kind of guide that also. So that's what I do as executive producer.
You worked with some of the greats in radio. You mentioned Hal already, but Parley Bayer, Walker Edmiston. Were there ever any particular plot points or pieces of a script that were written specifically because of an actor's prior work in some other venue? Or?
Almost, in a lot of ways, almost everything had at least something in mind. Or we would find something out while we would do something with that actor and then and incorporate later in other shows. But certainly when we, with Hal, obviously his prior role on on Andy Griffith, we didn't incorporate a town drunk into it. We just kind of avoided that. Don't know why, but we did. We did try and pattern when we could, pattern characters after characters they had done. One of the characters in Andy Griffith we'd worked with, we patterned into the Pocanberry Falls show. I believe his character is Ellis. And we patterned him after the character that he had done on Andy Griffith. Not quite as crazy, but that kind of the wild guy, and he had the boo-hoo-hoo kind of crazy voice. Yeah. We did that with a number of different characters, but we'd always try and play to their strengths. One of the great surprises was Earl Bowen. Earl Bowen, who was a phenomenal voice actor, actually a very legit actor, done a great deal of Shakespeare, and you could hear that in his voice when he played Blackard, that very dark, you know, kind of voice. And then when he played his brother, the most expedient, you know, English accent, of course, he could really tap into that. He was a phenomenal actor, phenomenal straight-up actor, really, really good guy.
Well, let's switch gears a little bit, talk a little bit more about the acting side of things. I mean, you played a lot more characters than just George Barkley. I mean, according to the AIO wiki, you played over 25 different characters, so...
Don't ask me what they were, because I can name one specifically, and the rest, most of the rest, I could probably name two specifically, but most of the rest were character voices. Whenever they needed someone in the crowd who could do an English accent or an Irish accent or an Italian accent or something that had more of a cartoonish flavor. But the two that most people are familiar with, especially from the early years, is Dr. Schnitzelbunker.
He was that guy who talked like this. He's kind of crazy. Had this little crazy little German voice. He talked really, you know, goofy crazy.
And then the other was... And I can't remember his name. It was, I played a Western guy and talked like this. Had a very strong voice and would, father, be, behave yourself, father. I don't know what my name was, but.
Jeremy Cartwood?
Yes, Jeremy Cartwood. Very good. Thank you very much. See? You know far more. He's got a cheat sheet, folks. He's got a cheat sheet, which is better because my brain is definitely not his cheat sheet. Well, it's a blank sheet, in fact.
And quite a few of those, I think, were back in the day. Very beginning when Chris would come in and interact with some character to kind of set up the
episode. We'd do a 3 to 5 minute opening bit that was short and funny and really maybe thematically would be tied. Usually it was thematically tied to what the show was about. Yeah. But the storyline was not. It was just completely separate and really did. It was really, it lent itself more to a cartoonish, fun, goofy kind of setting. I'd love to go back and hear some of those. In fact,
actually,
here's some of the cases I did.
Speaking of which, they're actually playing those on the radio again. They went back to the beginning.
Is that right?
They're playing those through, so we've been listening to them again, and it's just hilarious. I love going back and listening to the old ones.
Well, we had a lot of fun, and I will tell you from the creative team standpoint, all of us pitched in. Phil did voices. Phil was great. Paul did some. And we always gave him a hard time because of his lack of dimension. That's right, Paul. Lack of dimension. but we had a lot of fun doing that. A lot of fun. And Hal would, you know, participate on some of them also. Some of the other actors would, too. So it was a lot of fun.
The one that we just listened to actually last night was Chris came in and played a Western wife. When they were racing for the deed to... established the town of Odyssey, the two McAllister brothers. And that was really interesting, too, to hear it kind of the announcer jump in, and you know who it is.
Yeah.
So it was really hilarious.
Yeah, Chris is very talented. She can do a lot of voice work, too. She did a few voice things for us over the years as far as additional voices, but, you know, Chris is Chris. And what's fun about Chris, for those who've never met Chris, or for the few who perhaps haven't seen Chris, she's one whose voice fits her. You know, if you were to meet her, she's bright and bubbly and just blonde and just really fits the character.
Can you share with us how your daughters, Erin and Sage, came to play the Jacobs girls?
Actually, it's pretty easy. One, they were my kids. it was not a nepotism thing. It just happened to be that Sage, first, was really good. She was a really fast read. She was in the 13-part series. She was in Dental Dilemma. And before that, she did a piece called... you can help me with the name of it. But it was based on a true story that we wrote about where my daughter, when she was in grade school, went to school with a little girl. Karen. Went to school with a girl who was a little ballet girl, and she had a pain in her leg, came home one day, and they x-rayed it, found out she had cancer. The long and the short of it is Karen ended up dying. And it was very touching, and writing that and Sage performing, it was very touching. I get emotional thinking about it. and it was really a neat time. But she was very, very good. Sage read at an early age, because when we do these shows, you have to be able to read. You don't memorize. Right. You go in and read the scripts, and she could read on the fly. So she was easy. We plugged her in early. My younger daughter, Erin, is 2 years younger than Sage, was not as fast to read. She was just was not as quick a read at the same age. So we brought her in later after she could read quickly. And that's when we established it. And it was actually pretty easy. What was great was they actually were very good opposite each other, mainly because it didn't take any acting for them to argue. It was just, it was one of those, just turn on the microphone and please, go ahead. And, so they were always good together, and actually very easy to direct. They took direction, which I appreciated. It's not always easy as a dad to either direct or produce something when your kids are involved, but they were really good.
Was there any particular reason why they ended up being cast as children in another family rather yeah. than...
Well, one, they came after Jimmy and Donna, so they weren't going to be in my family. We cast Phil, as you know, as the father, Mr. Jacobs. And they hit it off great. So it was really kind of the timing. It was more a timing issue than anything else. And finding kids was not easy. I mean, finding kids that could really deliver the goods and not sound like they were reading lines was not an easy thing, but both Sage and Erin could do that.
And what ages did they come on
Sage at? Started at 8 on the first show, on the first before Odyssey, in that preliminary shows. And then 10, I think, is what, so it's 10 and 12. I think Erin came on at the age of 10. Maybe 11, but in that range.
There were many, many poignant scenes that featured the Barkley family, where you, as George, you shared different things, instruction or whatever, with the children, and it came across as so real and believable. How difficult was that to do that?
Actually, it wasn't. We had the three of us had a great relationship. They were both talented kids, but anxious to do well in the studio. And we had fun. I think you could sense that. One of the things you could sense in all of the shows is that the actors had fun. We created a great environment. The kids, both kids and adults, had a great time. The adults treated the kids great. The kids treated the adults with respect. We laughed a lot. And the only challenge we had in the Barkley family was I went through three wives. Let me clarify. I went through three actresses as my wife.
Yes.
But even that, it was an easy adaptation, and it was fun seeing the kids grow up.
Was there a particular episode where you had a tough time getting into the character of George, either because of the topic or anything?
Not that I remember. I think maybe perhaps the most challenging one for the character, getting into the character, was when one after Jimmy had grown up and left, and is the Washington D.C. where I try and he's been lying, and mm-hmm. I don't even remember the full storyline, but that was a little harder because I hadn't seen David, who plays Jimmy. I hadn't seen him in a while, and we had to kind of start over, and his voice had changed, and beyond the voice change episode
right.
that we did. He'd grown up a lot. So I think that was, I wouldn't describe it as difficult, but it's probably more challenging than some of the earlier ones.
Well, one of the ones that the fans really know is the prodigal Jimmy. The last few scenes of that episode, it just packed a really emotional punch in there, and just the whole message of it. Of course, we can relate that to God looking back yes. at us as we come back after we've done some stupid things when played Zappos
right.
all day. And so, that, I mean, I just wanted to bring that one up in particular. Just, you know, that's one of our favorite, at least personally, one of my favorite
was,
ones with George and Jimmy interaction right
yeah,
there.
Yeah, it was for us, too. I think to your mention about the clothes, it was emotional and frankly easy to do. Because of what we talked about just before, we had a lot of love for each other. There isn't a person on the planet that doesn't seek and want forgiveness. There isn't a person, a father on the planet, that doesn't wish the best for his son. And that's what happened in that. It was easy to translate into that, into the reality, even though I don't have a son. It was easy to translate that into the reality of what we're experiencing for both of us. But I know particularly for me, it was... It's very, very meaningful. Very meaningful.
Well, and David has, we've spoken with David, and yeah. he mentioned how especially you two, had a really good relationship in the studio, and he really, really appreciated the relationship that you guys had.
Yeah, it was a good relationship, and we would, you know, he was young, so there were times when I would, there were times I had had a sit-down talk with him once to kind of straighten him out, because he was goofing around and stuff when he shouldn't have been. It was much like a father and son. I mean, it really was. Now, it's not like we saw each other all the time, but when we did, we'd drop right back into it. And that father and son thing extended even when the microphone was off, which I appreciate and still to this day appreciate.
And you mentioned the episodes Living in the Gray, when, you know, you guys have been separated for so long, and then he comes back and he's going through all these things, and I wanted to play this clip from that episode to get your reaction to it, looking back after all these years, and then in relation to what you were just saying about how you felt about that scene.
Bye, Jimmy.
Wait.
What?
I have a question for you.
Okay.
Can I come with you?
What? To where?
Back to Pokenberry.
Are you wearing a pacemaker? Do you have any artificial limbs? No. Ow! Be careful with that stick.
Sorry.
Jimmy, I don't understand.
Could you take off your shoes?
Sure. Jimmy, what do you mean?
I want to come home.
But what about your job?
Well, that's something we need to talk about.
You're clear. Proceed. All right, thank you. Can I go back this way now?
Yes, but you'll have to go through screening again.
That's fine.
No, Dad, don't do that. No, it's no big deal. Maybe I'll come home in a couple weeks. Just, you know, go on and catch your flight.
Jimmy, what's going on?
I would really like to come home sometime, Dad, that's all. Can I still do that?
You can always come home.
Yeah, I know. Hey, you're gonna miss your flight.
I don't care. Son, you didn't spend all your money on Zappazoids again, did you?
Something like that.
Come on. Let's talk about it.
Yeah. It's about time.
Yeah, that was a sweet... Because it really did play back into the memory of the, as we jokingly refer to the Zappazoids, plays back into that same emotion. I think, too, for Dave and I, especially during that, some of that was very real to him. I don't know if he talked about this, but some of his own struggles, things that all of us go through, but he was going through prior to that and during that time. Even just for him... the loss of doing Odyssey as he got older and the characters were no longer written into the show. It was a loss for everybody, but I know it was a loss for Dave. And I think for him to come back, that had a lot of emotion, a lot of feel. It was just great, a father seeing his son again.
And it was the first appearance that was originally aired in 2004.
Wow.
The first appearance on the show since 1997.
Is that right?
Huge gap.
It's nice to know these things. I didn't know these things.
7 years.
Wow. Quite a while. Yeah, I knew that there was a big gap there. It's funny. I remember the session well. A lot of sessions I don't, because, I mean, to be blunt, as you can imagine, with the number of shows recorded, and it's not that they all blend together. Each one may have a distinct thing. But that one I remember well, one, because it had been a number of years. And one, two, I appreciated the fact that they're bringing the characters back because I've been gone for a while. And we recorded at Disney, the studios at Disney, and it was a nice... It was a nice setting, and we had a lot of people there. A lot of the full cast was there because we did, I don't know how many shows we did. It was nice because it gave me a chance to see virtually everybody that was there. Obviously, Hal had already passed away, but everybody else, Paul Herlinger, Walker was there. It was the whole nine yards.
After we spoke with Dave, I don't know if I've ever seen a show impact an actor as much as Odyssey really impacted him. You could really tell from talking to him that it had been such a huge part of his life, and he had taken away from that so many things, and is now, you know, basing some things he's working on himself off of his experiences in Odyssey. We've even spoken with him about an audio drama that he's doing, he's basing it off of his Imagination Station adventures.
Ah.
So you can tell that it really had such a big impact on his life. It's really amazing.
Yeah, it is. And I think I would say perhaps for him as much or more than any of the other children actors. I think part of it was because he had never, he'd have people come up and tell him, you know, hey, you're Jimmy Barkley, or they'd hear his voice. And it's a different thing, you know. It's not, you're not talking about, you know, Brad Pitt level stardom here, but there is a recognition factor. And when you're a young person and that happens, and when you're in a situation that's that creatively energizing for something that he never dreamed it would have happened. We got him out of a little creative school, Martin Craig at First Baptist Pomona had a group of theater group that he worked with, and got him from there. And it certainly was more than that. I mean, the people in the theater group were expecting it to, so it really did mean a lot. And I know spiritually it had an impact on him, as it did on all of us.
Well, and even though George hasn't appeared on the show since 2004, he was mentioned in it as recent as 2012 in episode 713, 714, I can't remember which. It was a two-parter, but...
I didn't know that. How was I mentioned? I mean, how was he mentioned? What did they say? What was it? Or do you remember?
It was a whole mix-up where everybody thinks Connie's going to marry Wooten, the mailman. And,
yes.
So she mentions how she gets a call from George Barkley asking if she needs counseling.
Ah, well, that's funny. Well, maybe I could marry them, although they would never get married. That would be a disaster.
Because the next person asks him if... Oh, premarital counseling? No, just counseling because I want to marry Wooten.
But thank you very much. Well, nice to know I'm still on the, or I should say, the character is still on the lips of some.
Yes. And they're very careful to say in any time that they have interviews with the producers and things that they never write anybody completely out of a show. They're always willing to pull somebody back in, so...
Well, who knows? Yeah, one of the things that's nice is that my character, supposedly, I guess I'm still in Pokenberry Falls. Am I still there?
I guess. Seems like it.
Yeah. That's good to know. But, you know, I'm still a pastor, and it really could be some ways to pull that in. So are you listening, guys, in Odyssey? Pull the character back in.
I think we'd all agree on that.
Yes, definitely.
Can you share a bit about the decision to actually move the Barkleys out of Odyssey?
I don't remember exactly what triggered our going from him going just being in business to the ministry, other than we thought it would create an interesting story arc and give us a chance to look into a family that's transitioned. It's not just you're raised as a pastor, but you've gone into as a pastor. We thought it would create some interesting drama, which it did.
Yeah.
And that was the main catalyst behind it, as I recall. And unfortunately, it worked. I mean, really, there were some nice things that came out of that. It created more tension in my character because I had to be a little more aware, a little less flippant. I was, you know, I got criticized in the early years. It was pretty funny. We at Odyssey, we would always, and Dr. Dobson was always adamant about reading mail. So we would make decisions to change characters based on 5 negative letters. You know, we get 5 million letters or something, you get 5 negatives, and and I'm sure you're aware of, we got rid of
Officer Harley.
Officer Harley and went to Harlow Doyle because of that. And this, I got criticized as a father because I wasn't perfect. I mean, because I would do goofy things, or I wasn't consistent, or basically, because I was normal, I'd get criticized, and that was it was interesting because I think there was a small group that wanted everybody to be just, you know, if you're a Christian, you do the following 10 things and you don't err on the way. Mm. But one of the things I've always appreciated from the very beginning when I came in was I wasn't going to let that happen. And Dr. Dobson, I honor him for this, though he was, you know, he's very strong, was very clear about things, gave us a lot of creative latitude. And my view was one of the weaknesses of most Christian writing, and certainly Christian recording, was that they treated kids like they were stupid, and talked down to children, and made everything had to be wrapped up in a neat little bow at the end of every show. And that's just not how life is. And I didn't want any part of that. And the only way I wanted to be a part of something is if it had some reasonable reflection of what real life is like. Families aren't perfect. Dads aren't perfect. Moms aren't perfect. And I don't care if they're Christians or not. They're human. unless, of course, excluding you two, of course. And that, you know, and so that's why, for instance, why we took so long. We took over a year for Connie to come to Christ. We took how many years before Eugene came to Christ? And that was all intention. And not everybody comes to Christ. And that was one of the things that was I always have appreciated and continue to appreciate about Odyssey.
Well, and I think that's probably linked to the longevity of the show is because it is so real. I mean, people can relate to the sketches that are portrayed in these episodes.
Right.
Even though those Pokemary episodes aired in January of 96, you were still credited as executive producer until June 96. Well, can you tell us a little bit about your transition out of working with Focus?
Sure. I had been approached by a headhunter organization, an executive search firm, about running an organization called Child Help USA. It's a national child abuse prevention and treatment organization. And when I got the call, my first question was, why are you talking to me? I'm not a social worker. I know nothing about child abuse. I really don't want to know about child abuse, particularly. And they just said, well, your name had come up and gave me some other reason. I said, well, thank you very much, but no thanks. So they called again and said, look, your name keeps coming up from different sectors, and whenever that happens in our world, that means we pay attention, and so we'd like you to at least consider being interviewed. And so I had them send me some materials and saw the materials were good and was impressed with them. And and this would have been now May of 1995. And so I was. They asked if I would be willing to be interviewed by the founders of the organization. So I said yes. I was out in L.A. for a recording session. I was interviewed by the founders. Shortly after that, they offered me the job. This is August. I said, if you need an answer right away, the answer is no. They said, no, we'll wait. So they waited, and they kept waiting. They kept waiting. And they kept asking me to do things for them, and I did not want to do anything for them without committing to them. I didn't want them to spend money on me, basically. And so after the new year, they asked me to come out to an event at the end of the year, and I demurred. After the first of the year, they had another event down in Florida. They wanted me to go. They had to do with Major League Baseball. And so I said, all right, I'll go down and I'll give you an answer when I can. I'll make my decision down there. So I went down, made the decision. This is February of 1996. Made the decision to make the shift and came back, let everybody know on the team that I was going to leave in April. And my last, I don't even know what my last day was, but April 1st or April 15th, somewhere in there. Of 96, and started with Child Help at that time. And what was behind the move, very simply, was like anybody else that makes a move in their life, I felt like it was time for a transition. I could have stayed very easily and happily stayed at Focus. I did not leave for any specific reasons. Sometimes people leave because they're tired or they're disgusted or they're whatever, but no. I felt like this was a new challenge. It was really outside my comfort zone, and I was at an age and stage where I felt like I needed to challenge myself professionally in that area. Glad I made the move. Missed everybody. Difficult move, but glad I did.
Did you recall who came up with the idea of moving the Barkley? I mean, I'm assuming that was a result of your decision to leave.
You mean as far as moving to Bokenberry?
Yeah.
No, actually, I'm trying to think. Actually, you should ask, when you talk to Paul McCusker, ask him that question. I don't recall that being the case. I may have been, but the decision was made. We may have already recorded. We recorded.
It was aired January 96. So it was,
January? So that was, before.
Yeah.
No, because I hadn't made the decision yet. No, so it definitely wasn't. Yeah, definitely wasn't.
So potentially they could have continued with some storylines along with the Barclays even there, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. I actually don't. I don't know what the thinking was other than the kids were growing up, you know, and they were gone. And we were in, I think that was part of it, in that they brought in the little Jimmy, I forgot.
Stuart,
thank you. Forget my own son's name. the rest, it's, you know, it happens with age. But when they brought the character Stuart in, my assumption when we talked this through was that as our kids, Jimmy and Donna, got older and they would transition out because we let them age, that Stuart would kind of fill that gap and we'd still intermittently use them. But it just didn't evolve that way. You know, we made the move to the Pokeberry thing, which incidentally was one of the most fun shows we ever did. It was just a great, great show. A lot of fun. Because it was tied directly to It's a Wonderful Life, which I think you're aware of that. So yeah. It was a lot of fun.
Well, Chuck, I really appreciate you taking the time to meet with us and share some of your experiences with the fans. I know they're going to love this, so thank you very much.
My privilege, and I hope your fans keep listening. I look forward to hearing this stunning interview.
Thank you.
Wow, that was a blast.
That was an amazing interview.
Yes,
absolutely amazing.
It was.
I just want to say thank you to JD, our illustrious interviewer extraordinaire, who asks some of the best questions
he does
ever. Yeah. So
he's the one that comes up with all of our questions for our interviews, and he is an amazing interviewer.
Oh, that's enough, guys.
You notice he let us go on there for about a whole minute before he shut in.
He's like, I'll edit this.
No, but it was really cool to sit down and talk with Chuck. And did you guys hear that? Odyssey team, he wants to come back. So
I think everybody would be happy about that.
Everybody.
Yeah, so you have 3 more votes. So that's with Chuck, 4. And we know that David Griffin wants to come back. So
yeah. And
Go ahead.
Yeah. When in the podcast that AIO, the official podcast, is just did, he said, yeah, send in your letters, you know. Yeah. Tell them to bring Jimmy back.
Exactly. And we know that they do it. They've done it twice since, you know, he quote unquote left the show or whatever.
Right. So anyway, just in case the AIO team is wondering if the fans really want it. Yeah, we do.
Mm-hmm. No doubt.
And the actors do too. So come on. You know, I think it would be kind of cool to, I mean, they don't have to bring them back as a full family again and have a bunch of episodes centered around them, but just, you know, bring them back on occasion every, you know,
once an album.
Yeah.
How do we put this? Yeah. Once in a great album or so.
Yeah. I think that would be cool. Well, I mean, this whole episode has been very Barkley family centered, with the mention of Roy's mention of the AIO podcast, you know, interviewing David Griffin and, of course, talking with Chuck. So we thought it would be kind of cool to just mention some of our favorite Barkley family episodes and get some feedback from you guys, see what you think. Let us know what your favorite Barkley family Adventures in Odyssey episodes are and why. So who wants to kick things off?
One that comes to mind, I believe it's called Family Vacation.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the two-parter?
Mm-hmm. It depends on which one you're talking about.
Okay, I'm thinking of two, actually. There's the one where they go to the woods.
Hopwood?
Yeah, they're Hopwoods. Yeah, Hopwood. There's that one, which a line that always sticks around, you know, even today in my family is, you know, little cows, don't they make little cows? That, you know, I believe that was the right word.
Yes.
Right wordage there, but yes, that line always stuck in my brain. So I remember that episode sticks out in my mind. I believe it's like one of the first Barkley family vacation episodes or mm-hmm. Barkley episodes I've heard. That one, and then also the one where they didn't have enough money to go out of town, so they did the staycation.
Yes, you know? Yes, that yeah. was good.
And the whole thing, the line that all it's not the Barkleys are not saying it, but the line, you know, get it, got it, good, yeah. you know, stuck in your mind.
Which episode is that? I'm trying to.
That one is The Best Vacation Ever.
That's it.
Oh. Yeah.
And then the other one is called Family Vacation. Family Vacation, one and two.
Mm-hmm. The Best Vacation Ever. They have a tent in their living room and everything.
Yeah. Yes, I love that one.
And for those of you that were listening, you know, Chuck kind of pulled out a couple of his voices for us there in the interview too. So
yeah. No, and in during the interview, I mentioned a couple of mine, the Prodigal Jimmy. And, of course, the Pokenberry. I mean, that one's kind of bittersweet because it was a really good episode and really well-written, great storyline. But, you know, then you also know that was the end of the Barkleys as, you know, as a regular on the show.
And looking back on it now, I mean, as a kid, I didn't know, like, I did not, I wasn't processing that, you know, like, oh, this is it for them, you know, I'll never hear them hear it
exactly.
again. But looking back on it now, I can see, like, how that episode really...
How much of a bummer it was.
I know, yeah. You know, hearing Jave talk about it, you know, like, wow, this actually is their last episode recording and everything. I was like, wow, okay. You know, I never thought of that episode being, like, the last one, you know, because I've heard other ones with them in there, but it was close to the end.
Yes, exactly.
How about you, Andrew?
I have to go with another Barclay Vacation episode. Is the one where they went to Hawaii.
Of course, Aloha Oi.
I don't think you can't think about the Barclays without thinking of this episode.
Yeah, that one's the best to me.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But this is just one of many favorites.
Was that two parts or three?
Three.
That's what I thought. A three-part Barclay family vacation. That's cool.
Yes.
That was probably one of the first three-part that they ever did, wasn't it?
Pretty close.
Maybe not. But that is a classic. I mean, yeah, like you said, Roy, when you think of the Barclays, that one has to come to mind.
Mm-hmm.
Another one we mentioned when we spoke with Jave a few episodes back was Someone to Watch Over Me. Which didn't feature the whole family, but Jimmy and primarily Jimmy, but of course the last few scenes with his dad. That was a great episode.
Yeah.
There's not very many other families in Odyssey that I can think of right now where there was a lot of vacation episodes. I mean, because we have that very first one, you know, when they take Wit's Boredom Buster along with them, you know?
Yeah, that's the one Roy was talking about there.
And then you got the Aloha Oi. That's another vacation one. Then you got the best vacation where they stayed at home. And then you have the ski vacation one.
Right.
So there's a lot of them.
Well, yeah.
Yep, I was never thinking about that. The ski vacation too as well.
We haven't had a family go on a vacation recently.
No, not very recently.
I mean, if we have the Mystery at 10 Flat, that was, of course.
Yeah, that's a vacation.
But that was a while ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that was a good episode, too.
It was. It's not a three-parter vacation, but it's a good episode.
Any others that come to mind? Of course, Pokenberry Christmas.
Yeah.
That one's great.
A really good one. I was thinking of that one.
And I like the Moses, the Passover, whenever...
Jimmy and...
Yes.
Yep, that one was really good.
Mr. Barkley going to the Imagination Station together. Yeah.
Yep. And we mentioned this to Chuck, but there was something about the way he brought that character of George Barclay to life. It was so believable and real. The way he interacted with the kids and the way those scenes, I mean, I don't know. To me, those Barclay episodes where there was a lot of fun times and especially the vacation ones, but man, he had a real talent for just making those poignant moments just stand out and really pack a big punch. And I think that's one of the great things about Odyssey.
Yeah.
Well, we could just keep going on and on. There's so many episodes that feature the Barclay family. I mean...
Lincoln.
Yeah.
That's another Jimmy episode, really, but...
Yeah.
Yep. I mean,
and they really touched on some of the most... important parts of growing up with the Barclays. And
yes.
They had the show where Jimmy's voice was changing. They had
Donna
with modesty. The whole modesty thing. Mm-hmm. There was so many that they covered every theme you could really cover with the Barclay family.
Yeah. Well, family issues and family, like stuff that comes up in a family.
Right.
You know, being a family show, they did.
Even a businessman becoming somebody going into the ministry. I mean, they covered everything.
Right.
Yeah! Wow, financial, longest running family ever.
Financial hardships in a family, you know.
Yep.
Budgeting.
Yeah. And I don't mean this to sound too negative, but it seems like a lot of the family interactions of late on the show have really taken on more of a cartoonish nature to me. Yeah. They don't really cover those real life issues as much anymore. It seems to me, like, for instance, with the Parker family, with Olivia just throwing a fit because she wanted to be part of the camp staff with Wooten. And there was that kind of a nice moment with her and her father just kind of having a heart-to-heart talk. But that, I mean, sure, some kids could probably relate to that, and some families can relate to that type of a situation. But is that really a real big issue that can that was tackled in a really neat way that really hits home? I mean, it didn't seem they're not deep issues. Am I making any sense?
Yeah, I do. I understand what you're saying. It almost seems kind of over the top.
Exactly.
But how much, like, can they keep bringing up?
Right. That's what I was thinking, too.
Like, we did a Barkley episode about this. Can we bring,
Well, does it have to be the same issue? No. I mean, they could... I mean, I'm sure there's other...
And, I mean, I guess this is possibly since the refresh, if you want to call it that, after album 50. But, I mean, we just had Grady and Mandy, all of their family issues. So...
That's true.
I don't know.
And those are pretty real life issues.
Very. Mm-hmm. I mean, with Mandy's parents almost getting divorced, with Grady being, a boy with a sister and a single mom, all that stuff.
Right.
So, I don't know. Maybe it'll come back. Maybe they're just taking a break from all
the heaviness.
Really heavy stuff. Because it does seem to run in cycles a little bit.
Yeah.
And we have to remember, too, that they were producing Odysseys much faster at that time.
And maybe part of it is just a little bit of a nostalgia on my part, just because, I mean, I'm so attached to that era of Odyssey.
Right.
Maybe that's what it is, too. Those really resonate with me, probably because I was a kid when I heard them the first time. Maybe that's what's going on. I don't know.
Yeah. I could see that.
Any other comments on the Barkleys in general, or...
We probably better wrap it up, because if we don't, we're just going to keep talking.
Yeah, exactly. The Barkley episode when Mary went into labor. They were doing that.
Oh, the Christmas show.
Yes.
That one was awesome, too.
To Us a Peace Son on, Is Born or something like that.
I think it was
To Us a Peace Child on Earth? Is Born.
Wasn't it Peace on Earth?
I think it's number 294.
No, Peace on Earth was the one where they got their gifts stolen.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's a good one, too. That's a good one, too, where they wake up the next morning.
Yep, and then you have the one where they find the family in their...
The visitors.
They basically have, the angelic visitation.
Yeah. Yeah,
that was really cool, too.
They actually reproduced that one in Spanish. I don't know if you ever heard it.
No?
Yeah.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, it's not the Barkleys, George, yeah.
Sure.
But they actually did the whole episode in Spanish.
It's the Ramirez's Gonzalez's.
Exactly. So...
Well, as has already been mentioned, we got to stop this, or we could just talk all day. But we want to know what you think. What are some of your favorite Barkley family episodes? Should AIO bring back the Barkley families, even if in a small way, once in a while? Even if they can't, get another Mary and Donna. Is this wrong to say that I think more people resonated with George and Jimmy than they did with Donna and Mary?
I don't know. I think the whole family together was really believable and nice.
But yeah.
Probably. I mean, I did. But I'm a guy, so that kind of makes sense, actually.
Well, yeah. I guess I am, too. So.
Yeah. But let us know. Let us know what you if you want them back or what you think. Shoot us a quick text or something. We have a number you can send that to, 623-688-2770. And let us know what you think.
And, of course, you can always email us, feedback@audiotheatercentral.com. Leave a message or leave a comment on our show notes. Show notes for this episode at audiotheatercentral.com/35. And, of course, our website is, I'm sure you guessed, audiotheatercentral.com.
This is theater with an R-E, too.
Exactly.
We have to throw that in there because you could type in audio theater central and come up with, we don't know what. Because we've never looked at it. Because it's not worth looking at, I'm sure.
Well, actually, I have contemplated buying that domain and just having it forward to ours, which I really should do just because I know there are people that type out that wrong address. But so, of course, let us know what you think. And you can find us on Stitcher, TuneIn, of course, in iTunes.
Of course, in iTunes. No, just kidding. Leave iTunes reviews.
Yeah.
You missed your line, Andrew.
Who leaves iTunes reviews? No one. That's the problem. No, I'm just kidding. We've had some very great listeners that have left iTunes reviews, but not enough of them.
We'll see you next time, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Audio Theater Central is a production of Radio CSS Media. RadioCSS.com.
As far as radio theater is concerned, that was something that we had seen based on the response from Odyssey. The radio, any kind of drama in radio, could work done well. And it was out of that simple understanding that the experimentation of doing the Christmas Carol, which was the first radio drama series, that we experimented with it to see if we could make it work. We knew we could. I mean, we knew it worked. We just didn't know what the station's response. Keep in mind, this is when everything was done based on whether a station would air something, when they would air it, and then whether we would get response from it. Well, the challenge with radio theater was it wasn't a half-hour deal. We're talking stations that have to carve an hour or more or create a special series out of this thing to be able to air it, which not all stations were willing to do. Fortunately, Focus had its reputation was high, our success rate was high, and so when we did create something, there's a greater likelihood they were going to air it. And that was because that, again, was successful. And the success was measured not by sales of the item, but response in letters, what kind of people say, and not just quantity, but even measuring what people would say spiritually about what their reaction was to it. And so that's what kind of launched the whole radio drama series.